The Forever GM never stops thinking about how to make games better. If you are one, want to be one, or would like to find one, you're in the right place. Welcome to the Forever GMs Podcast, the roundtable where two professional game masters dig into the craft of running games for a living alongside professionals in the RPG industry. My name's Jesse Edmond, but you can call me Doc.
And I'm Olivia Larby, but I go by Liv. Together, we are professional game masters who have spent years running games for the players of all kinds, at home tables, online, and for clients around the world. We've created this show to pull back the curtain on what it really takes to run great games consistently, sustainably, and professionally. And today we have two fantastic guests joining us, Senda Leno and Phil Vecchione.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the first episode.
It's really exciting to be here for your...
inaugural episode.
Thank you. Inaugural was the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Leave it to Phil to have the right word. Before we get into our topic, we're going to do every episode, we're going to do a game spotlight. Today, our game spotlight is going to be a little game that you may have heard of called Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition is sort of the default game for this hobby. I think that when most people think of the RPG hobby, they think of D&D. And part of that is because it was the most popular. If I'm pretty sure it was the first, although I've heard people argue that, but I'm pretty confident it was the first. But at the same time, it's right now by far the most popular role-playing game that's out there. The reason that this hobby is either in the mainstream or getting close to the mainstream is that the Dungeons & Dragons has become incredibly popular. It's also something that a lot of people build a lot of things for. So you can find a lot of options for D&D. And also because there's a huge history there, if you want to dig back and find some interesting content that you can pull from, it's not that hard to kind of do a little digging and go back with that. So Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, first episode. There we go.
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
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 I play it pretty frequently.
For young dragon slayers, it's definitely the game that we run for our kids. I don't know if you've run anything other than that, Liv. I think that only a few other games have been run, but the variety of what we do with D&D is pretty out there. Are either of you doing much D&D these days? I know you guys have a bunch.
No,
of
we're both shaking our heads.
No.
It's actually been years since I've played D&D. It was 5th edition D&D was the last D&D that I played, but probably, I don't know, at least 5 years.
In that game spotlight thing, were you both introduced to the hobby with D&D?
Yes. Well, okay. I have an introduction story that I've told elsewhere. The first game I ever played was D&D. The first game I ever interacted with was not.
My story is not dissimilar. It's kind of like the first story or the first game I ever played was D&D, but it was the older kids wanting to get rid of the young kid. And so they just, hey, you made a halfling and he died. Like, there you go. And that was it. And then the first game I actually really, well, the first game I ran was Marvel Superheroes. And I had no idea what I was doing, but here I am. So something clicked in.
Obviously worked out for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything like specific to say about the fifth edition that you want to add to the discussion?
I think fifth edition for kids is actually, it's one of those things that we run pretty frequently. It's a good middle ground RPG. I think that most people, if they play a session of fifth edition, can figure out, oh, okay, what do I actually like about the role playing experience and what might be better games out there, or is this a game for me? And so that's why I really like it as a starting point for most people.
It's funny because I've played so many. I've joked before that I've run 8 different editions of the 5 editions of D&D. I feel like for me, 5th edition is in a lot of ways built to be that, like, we want this to be the product that people like, whereas some of the other ones are a little bit more obtuse. And I think that, I guess I'm agreeing with you, but I'm just taking a long walk around to get there.
Yeah, my experience with 5th edition was definitely that it felt like it took a lot of some of the newer thinking about RPGs and just blended it into that D&D DNA. So if I was going to go if the game that I wanted to play right now was fantasy, just sort of standard fantasy game, would I go back to 5th edition D&D? Sure, I totally could. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't bother me at all. but I'm not playing a lot of fantasy right now. Like, not playing a lot of standard fantasy. I'm playing a lot of, like, pirates and time travels nonsense and, you know, that kind of stuff. So,
all right. Well, yeah, fifth edition. hey, if you are if you were not familiar with fifth edition and you somehow found this podcast, good on you. Hey, welcome to the hobby. yeah, Liv, would you like to introduce our topic?
Yeah, so today is kind of an interesting one, as this is our inaugural episode of our inaugural season. And so we're going to be talking about building tools for gamers, but through the medium of podcasting. And so we'll talk a little bit about skills and tools that you might want to use at your tables, or, you know, that are out there for people through the podcasting lens. And so I do have an initial question for Phil and Senda, if you're ready for me.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I would love to know, like, how do you break down what it means to be a game master into skills or tools that can be taught through a podcast?
This is such an interesting question because I think, and I know I jumped in, Phil, and you're the one who frequently does the breaking down, but I just want to say before you get in here, I think our approach to this has actually changed pretty significantly over the years. We were just talking, we've actually been recording Pandas Talking Games for almost 10 years now, which is a little bit mind blowing, but it started as a 15-minute show, and the way that you approach this kind of answer for a 15-minute show is very different than what the show is now, which is an hour. And so the first part, I think, is that we tend to get very specific about what we're going to talk about, very much like this is the slice that we're going to talk about and give advice on, and we're not trying to get really broad just because there's a lot of sources for broad information. I have more thoughts, but Phil, do you want to get in there? Because you're the one who actually does a lot of the breaking down work.
So there's like 8 skills.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's actually an inside joke from our show. There are 8 skills. I just changed the names of what 8 they are at any given time. The way I've always looked at it, and this goes all the way back to the first Gnome Stew articles I've written and things like that, is that GMing isn't a skill, right? It's a collection of skills that span a whole bunch of different things, from story, like skills that involve storytelling, skills that involve story structure. It involves communication, people management, rules knowledge. Like, it is a whole host of skills. And so one doesn't learn like the GMing skill. You learn all of those individual skills at different speeds, and you have different levels of ability in them, and you have different affinities for different parts, like for different skills. And that's what makes up your taste and your style as being a GM.
Do you think that to some degree that there's kind of an ongoing assessment people have to have of like, here are the skills for this hobby, and here's where I am in this one, in this one, in this one? Almost, do DMs have to have their own character sheet where they their skills laid out?
I'm thinking about like the anime skill chart, honestly. Like, I have an A in this, but an E in this.
We actually have an episode that is like, how do you figure out, or like, just how can you approach thinking about what am I good at and what do I want to work on, right? Like, you don't have to work on anything. Like, that's part of it. You have the option to. Is something in here causing you stress or annoyance, or you just want to be better at it, and being able to identify what that specific thing is? And then from there, then you can look for specific information on that specific skill set, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, we live in this like charm time.
We do.
Where where like information about game mastering is pretty ubiquitous. Like if you, before you even know what the skills are, like you can go listen to an actual play and you can just say like, oh, I would like to GM like this, or I would like to be able to do something similar to this GM, to date myself, right? When I was a youth, there was no internet. There was barely a connected community. You did these things on your own. You maybe knew 2 other people who GM'd somewhere, and they weren't much help in terms of advice or helping you hone your skills. And it wasn't even really till like the, at least my recollection, right? It really wasn't till like about the mid to late 90s when Robin Laws did Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering that even anyone even approached GMing as a skill set. And that was a big deal for me. Like when I saw that, I thought that was, I thought that was a pretty big deal that, oh, this is a thing you could get better at. Could just, you know, like deliberately get better at, not just play more games. Although play more games also.
it's not a bad way to get better at it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think the interesting thing to twist it from a podcast perspective, because I know that your question was, how do you teach skills through a podcast specifically, right? Or at least the thing that I will say, and I think this probably will apply to more than just this question of yours, but I'll say it now and then we'll revisit it every time or something, is that we don't know exactly who's listening or what they're going to take away from the show. So what we're really doing at any given moment is saying, here's a tool maybe, or here's a discussion about a specific skill or how to approach a specific skill. Listen to the show. This is a buffet. Take what you like, take what works for you, and leave the rest, right? Like, we just have to acknowledge that the way that all of us GM ends up being really personal, because the way that we interact with those, I'm going to put bunny ears around this, 8 skills, unquote, is going to be different, just kind of depending on like who you are, your life experience, the way your brain works, all of that stuff, right? Ways that I GM games are sometimes drastically different than the ways that Phil runs games. And some of that is that we have different primary skills, and he's really good at training his up, and I get bored and I just don't. And that's a brain thing. And some of that is just that we have very different personalities. And that's part of the reason that I tend to run one shots and he tends to run campaigns. All that to say, offering a bunch of options so that people can decide what they choose to bring to their table or interact with, I feel like is a good way to approach it, because then you're like, we're talking about X, right? Here are some things you might want to consider or think about for yourself, or like think about how you personally approach this so that you can then fill in the gaps with whatever information, right?
I think just as a final thought on this from me, I think that treating it as a collection of skills rather than one monolithic skill is really good, because in some ways it gives people hope, right? Because because if you had to be good at every GMing skill,
man,
as one thing, that's a lot to ask of a person, right? But it's another to say like, well, look, I do decent enough voices and my rules knowledge is, you know, good enough. I'm going to spend this campaign really focusing on doing a better job at pacing.
Right.
Story pacing. It allows you to kind of like keep a couple skills leveled and funnel your finite energy and time into a couple skills that you might want to try to advance or hone. And I think that's
really
less daunting.
That kind of perspective that the two of you are putting out, because I think of, you know, when I talk to people about being a professional GM, they're like, oh, like Matt Mercer or like Critical Role or, you know, all of these really professional level things where it's like, yes, those are skills they have. They're skills they have because one, their personality, but two, they're also, you know, trained actors, comedians and things like that. And so I like this idea that you have these different skills and you can continue to build on them and you don't have to be, you know, Critical Role level out the gate. I think a lot of people have the misconception about Dungeons and Dragons and just TTRPGs in general.
I mean, I can't voice like Matt Mercer, but I don't know if Matt Mercer can keep a campaign Obsidian database like I do.
Right.
Different skill sets.
I have also definitely had conversations where, good question, on various podcasts just about actual play. I think is a fantastic example. I think it's a great way to get a brief introduction to a game and see if you like how it sort of feels like it plays. I definitely picked up a lot of my, you know, what works for me personally as a GM from listening to actual plays. But like the dark side of actual plays is that it is a whole bundle of skills and you might sit down and you might not be as good at all of those skills as the people that you're watching. And I don't want people to be disappointed by that, right? Like you just have to decide which ones are the most important to you and then work on those specifically.
And this isn't me trying to outside plug the other thing I did.
But here it comes. Yes, tell us, Doc.
Speak to us.
We just finished the last episode of an actual play that I was on with Chris Sneezak called Scritches. And that was kind of my first time actually like getting through an actual play. I think I tried launching like 3 before that. And Chris and I worked on another one. Getting it off the ground was one thing, but like the approach that we took wasn't here's a game and we're going to put it out there. It was we're going to produce a story that is a podcast. And you have to recognize that if you're listening to The Adventure Zone or Critical Role or Dimension 20, like those are produced pieces of fiction.
Or honestly, She's a Super Geek, which I was running, and I will sit here and tell you right now, most of those games, we aired them as they were, right? We cut the chaff and we aired them, but there were 100% moments, especially later in the show when I knew what I was doing, when I would look at the clock and be like, okay, folks, we have about an hour left. What do we think the most satisfying conclusion to this game is, and how do we play into that? Which you can totally do at your table, but did we air that when we played those shows back? No, we didn't. You didn't know that I said that. We were just telling a good story. And that story was bounded by those rules. But anyway, I definitely have steered us a little bit away from your original question.
This is great.
Well, I think, though, it's worth saying, though, that if you are looking at actual plays and going, I can never do that, like, there's a curtain.
There is definitely, there's totally a curtain. I mean, there's skills and you can learn skills, right?
Yeah.
There's also a curtain. It's called editing.
Yeah.
Editing is great.
Editing is great.
Makes the world go round.
When you are recommending systems on a podcast, how do you help listeners choose the right ones?
That's a really interesting question, because I actually think pretty recently, and when I say recently, it could be any time in the last year and a half, just to be clear, I don't remember, but sometime relatively recently to the recording of this show, we actually did a whole show, I think, about maybe not specifically choosing the right game for a person just sort of by itself, exclusive of context, but definitely about choosing the right game for what you're trying to accomplish and how your, again, personality or brainwaves, however you want to approach it, right? Like, likes to run games.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that discussion was talking more about how do you figure out what you're looking for than here is a game. Because I think if you've narrowed down what you're looking for, you can go on the internet, you can find a game. And Phil and I definitely don't know every game that's out there. I used to know so many more of them when people were coming to me and saying, let's have an actual play on your show. But like, the games don't bring themselves to me anymore. So I am way far behind. And I can't possibly say, like, here's the best game for XYZ. Sometimes I have recommendations, but that's only based on my experience. And there's a lot more games out there I don't know about. But what I can say is, if you like to play a short form game, or, you know, that is rules light or whatever, like, if you can narrow down those specific things that you are looking for, then that can help you narrow down either to a system or specific games, right, much more quickly, and then be able to go from there. And I think that's pretty much how we've generally approached this, although we definitely also sometimes talk about specific games, because just to be clear, our show is run on listener questions, so we don't just make topics and then go. We are bound by things that people actually ask us. And sometimes they're system specific and sometimes they're not.
Yeah. I mean, like, well, and I think the other thing too is, you know, not that, I mean, I guess I'm answering my own question a little bit, but I think when people come to me and like, what, you know, I want to start running games, you know, a lot of times when people come to me, it's people that, you know, the players that I have through YDS, where, you know, they're like, oh, I'd like to start running D&D. I'm like, great. But I have had a few times where it's like, I'd like to start running games, but I don't necessarily want to do D&D. And, you know, I think it's also like, you ask the questions, what they want it to do. And then you tell them which version of Powered by the Apocalypse they should probably run.
I mean, that's usually what I tell people. Yes, because for me, that is how my brain works. But yes.
Yeah.
But if you ask Phil, he'll say Cortex.
I might say Cortex, right?
Like, I mean, if they're starting out, maybe not. But
no, but I mean, it very much has to go to, you will run your best games when those are games that best fit the your style of GMing, mm-hmm. right? Which is hard when you are a new GM because you don't really know your style of GMing yet. It hasn't really solidified. So you're just, you know, in those cases, when you're first GMing, you should just try a bunch of different games.
Mm-hmm.
You should try as many things at the buffet as possible and start developing a taste for what you like and don't like. From there, like, if it's somebody who's played for a long time and, you know, said to me, like, you know, I want to run something, but I don't want to run Dungeons and Dragons, then the question is, well, which part of Dungeons and Dragons are you not interested in running? You know, the assumption is it's mechanically too complicated, but they might be perfectly fine with mechanics. They might just be like, I'm not great at fantasy. And it'd be like, cool. You know, there's that, what is it? The Pathfinder space game. I can't remember. Yeah.
Starfinder,
right? Equal amount of mechanics, you know, different flavor of genre. And so it becomes very much how a game fits you, because you have to manage that game, right? And so if you don't like managing it, then you won't manage it. Hence, Senda's fourth edition game that she ran and never learned the rules to the game and made somebody else at the table tell her the rules.
I managed that just fine. I just never read the rules. ever.
The point of that is, right, like, Senda managed the part of the game she was interested in because it wasn't a good fit for you.
Yeah.
It's terrible. That game is a terrible fit for me.
Yeah, I mean, for everybody's, like, worst game they've ever played is somebody's favorite game out there.
Yeah, I know.
Right? And nobody wants to yuck anybody's yum.
Yeah.
So it really is all about personal fit. And, you know, if you're like us, it, you know, games that fit your neuro spiciness.
Look at the four Nidan heads on here.
Yeah, definitely.
I think, Senda, you were saying this too. What might work for you as like a player, what worked for you as a GM oftentimes.
Yeah.
I love playing D&D 5e. I actually prefer Powered by the Apocalypse system to play in as a GM because I think that I could focus more on like the role playing, the voices, the story in those games than I can in 5e. But put me in there as a player all the time. I'll act absolutely wacky for you. And so it's really about, like you were saying, Phil, just like going to the buffet and choosing and trying a bunch of little things here and there and figuring what you like.
I have a similar experience with Numenera. I love playing Numenera, but when I GM Numenera, I get bored too quickly because there's nothing, like it's all player facing. So I wind up running out of, you know, like there's no knobs for me to turn mechanically. So I get bored. It might actually be a great fit for you because as mechanics go, it makes it light on the GM, which lets you really dive into story and character and everything else without having to worry about, you know, stat blocks and all of that stuff.
I love running a lot of different games. I don't like playing a lot of games is what I've kind of discovered.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there's only a few. I mean, I'm right now playing in a Mutants and Mastermind play by post game that I'm actually enjoying, which is weird because I hate running Mutants and Masterminds. And then also, I mean, there is a fifth edition one that I'm doing and I'm kind of like, meh. I don't know. It's a weird thing. I'll run anything. Occasionally, though, I like a game where I'm just an NPC villain in the actual game because I am. Doc Palindrome is a villain in this game.
Love it.
You have to say the name of it because you're on camera showing it to us. They can't hear you.
You're right. It is Galaxies in Peril by Simon's, by who put this out? It's Blaze in the Dark. No, I don't know. It's Forge in the Dark. It's a great game. I ran it and played it a bunch and I liked running. I didn't like playing it, but.
I think that's interesting because as your co-host, I am the former GM who keeps being asked to do games. I'd love to be a player. Like, yeah. I'd love for someone just to put together a game for me and sit there and do my cute little dice rolls. Like,
yeah.
Oh, it's funny. I'm actually the exact opposite. Like, I will play in games with certain people. Chris, I like to play in games that Chris runs because we're local, like, you know, we're in each other's neighborhood kind of thing. And we play in each other's games from time to time. But given the choice, I will always be the GM in a heartbeat. Like I am the forever GM, right? Like given a choice, I will be the GM. No question. You don't even have to ask. Like I'll do it. I'm in.
I am the exact opposite, but I'm happy to run games. But if you just said, what is your ideal world, Senda, I'd be like, yeah, I want to play. That's just me all the time. And it's interesting, but I like also having a mix. So right now I'm playing in two games and I have one game night that because the campaign kind of fell apart due to life circumstances, like I was just like, it's fine. I'll just come in and run a one shot every 2 weeks. That's fine. I can do that. That's my night that I'm running right now, which is it's a nice blend.
Nice.
How do you pick one shots to run for something like that?
Right now, honestly, I just keep showing up with things that require absolutely zero prep at all and saying, so what do y'all want to play? I got Lasers and Feelings,
yeah.
Love and Justice, Rocker Boys and Vending Machines. You might notice a theme here. I showed up last time with Fiasco as well, but we didn't have time to go through the setup for that one. And there's some others on my shelf. There's also a bunch of GM-less stuff, right? Like, so For the Queen has made some appearances. Fedora Noir, what an awesome game. I love that game. But it's very specifically for people, so it's a little bit hard sometimes to get out there. Pretty much I'm not planning at all is the answer.
I mean, I'm very much big on the, itch.io is having a bundle that they're selling.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I also know in my bag, and I'm just not unpacking it, I'll just bring it back again next time, is like, you know, a bunch of Jason Morningstar one-shot, almost parlor LARPs, things that like ride that border between being a LARP and a game. Or a tabletop game, a bunch of that kind of stuff too. So I'm just like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah. Just keep a pack of bubble gum and all out of bubble gum and you're good to go, I think.
Absolutely. They haven't played that with me yet either. but they will probably. And also Turning Point. There's going to be a Turning Point day for sure.
Yeah.
There's going to be a What are you up for today? Do you want fun or do you want to rip your heart out?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Let's go. It's a bunch of it is a bunch of LARPers. We're really into type 2 fun, so they're going to be on board when we do that, I'm sure.
Yeah. I think one of the things that that people need to recognize is that there's so many options out there that it's worth doing some searching. Let me just explain to Liv what All Out of Bubblegum is. There's a line in a movie years ago that is, "I'm here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum."
I'm familiar with that line, yeah.
You're familiar with that line. It was delivered by the greatest wrestler ever, Roddy Piper. And but the game is you get 5 sticks of bubblegum, and each time you choose not to kick ass, you have to eat a piece of bubblegum. No, is that, am I missing it? What am I doing wrong?
No, you have 5. Well, let's see if I remember the rules now. They're all of 3 sentences long.
Yeah, I know.
Think we would remember. But so you have 5 pieces of bubblegum. If you want to do something normal,
yes,
you have to roll under how much bubblegum you have on a D8, a D10?
Something
I don't
like
remember.
Yeah.
A D10. And every time you fail that roll, you lose a stick of bubblegum.
Yeah.
And anytime you want to do something kick-ass, you have to roll over how many sticks of bubblegum you have.
Okay.
So, like, as the game progresses, it gets harder and harder to do normal things, like open doors or, like, make a phone call, and easier to do the wildest stuff that you can possibly imagine. You have to come up with the weirdest way to do things. So it goes off the rails very quickly, and you really can't play it for longer than about 2 hours. That would be my assessment of that game. Yeah.
So yeah, but yeah, so literally there's any kind of game you could imagine that's out there.
What is the first step you take when starting a new game, and how can that process be shared as a repeatable tool for your listeners?
Session zero?
It depends. So session zero is always my first. This is the first thing I do with players. The first thing I do is immerse myself in whatever genre the game is about. While I'm reading the rules, while I'm getting ready to prep the session zero, I will start consuming media around that genre because I want to refresh myself on the tropes, on, you know, just the kinds of stories that are told. I want to start getting imagery in my head of what, you know, this genre looks like. And again, I play a lot of different games, so like I'm switching genres almost every time I switch games. That's the first thing. My first interaction with the players will be session zero, because that's where we're going to set all of our initial expectations for the game. And I'm a huge session zero guy.
I'm also a huge session zero fan. And if you listen to any amount of Pandas, you'll also probably notice that we tend to tell you to do everything in session. Like, if you did everything that we told you you could do in session zero, in every session zero, you would have like 5 session zeros for every game.
Yeah.
5-part session zero.
Part 5, session 0.5.
I don't think anybody has here would necessarily get this reference, but as a father of a toddler, I think of an episode of Bluey, which is a wonderful show, where they want to play a game, and Bluey keeps adding new things to the game, and then the kids are getting like frustrated that they won't like start the game. And like, yeah, if you keep, like, at some point you got to say, let's go.
Yeah,
we just got to play the game. The last game that I started that we got off the ground, we did have 3 intro sessions, but to be fair, we were bad at actually doing the stuff while we were here. So it took us several nights. But I think the interesting thing is, and this is again, podcasting stuff, right? In terms of distilling, like, how do you turn things into a tool for your listeners? The important thing is still that you can identify not just what works for you, but a way to say, here are approaches.
Mm-hmm.
Find what works for you, listeners. And but my actual personal approach is very similar to Phil's. You should see my list of sea shanties right now. And I'm just playing in that game. I'm not even running it. That playlist is epic.
Rapscallion.
Yes, it's a fun game. I'm a big fan so far.
Rapscallion. I've heard a lot of really good things about it. I am excited at some point to play it, because some days I like to just do a pirate voice for no reason.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're only one actual play session in at this point. We play once a month, and March will be our 5th month.
That's a whole nother skill to learn, is the scheduling side of...
Yeah, it's a whole nother skill, right? The people wrangling, and also, like, if you're getting a bunch of people together, do you have to default to, like, GM has to do all of the paperwork, people pushing stuff? Maybe not. take some weight off of them.
I'm the default scheduler in my personal groups, whether I'm GMing or not. That is where I line up to be.
There has to be one, because when you don't have someone who does that, that's how groups fall apart. Yeah. Ask me how I know.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And you're very good at it, Liv. That's
like, why we're here today.
That's why we're here today. It literally is.
Yeah.
What lessons have you learned about turning RPG advice into something listeners can actually apply at their own table?
Buffet. Just go back to the buffet thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing you can do, because as I said when we first talked about it, right, like I cannot get in your head, and I'm not sitting there having a conversation with a listener. Like, the weird thing about being an advice show, especially a show like Pandas, where we receive a question and we have whatever context people provide to us with the question, and that's it. No more. We have to make some leaps of logic or assumptions. And sometimes we're like, okay, for this conversation, we are assuming X. If that's not true, then some of the stuff that we say from this point forward, it's not going to make any sense.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that's really important, and Phil, I might ask you to jump in on this because I'm just going to cue you up on it, is really making sure that you're talking about the same thing and your listeners are hearing the same thing.
Mm.
There's a lot of words that run around the just the RPG space that people don't necessarily talk about them with the same definition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think definition, right? Definition's key. Definition's key for the podcast part, right? Because you really need to, before you make an argument, give advice, that kind of thing, you really need to kind of set what exactly you're talking about, right? So if you're, you know, people will say things like, you know, railroad games are bad, but they sometimes are referring to linear structure plots and not railroads, right? Railroads, the absence of agency. Linear plots are just scene A goes to scene B that goes to scene C. They're not the same thing, right? But they look similar. And so when somebody says, like, I don't run these games because they're railroads, are you talking about an agency thing, or are you talking about a story structure preference? That kind of thing. So definitions, I think, is definitely one of them. I think the other one is, and Senda and I joke about this frequently, is that what's the root problem? We get people who write into us, and the problem that you're experiencing at the table is not always the root problem of what's going on.
It's a symptom.
9 times out of 10, we joke about this all the time on our show, 9 times out of 10, the answer is going to be communication.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that we do on the show is frame what communication we think you should be having. Whatever went wrong at the table is probably linked to communication. But how do you have the right conversation? How do you get to the right problem, difference, et cetera?
So many issues in life are just lack of communication. Uh-huh. So.
Yeah.
So many. And the thing is, when you get a bunch of people together to play a game, you're a bunch of people.
Like, yeah.
Even when you're trying to be clear, sometimes you say something and someone hears something else.
Yeah.
We are messy humans that bring all of our emotional stuff to the table and all of our preconceptions and everything. And then we all attempt to talk to each other and try to stay on the same page for hours on end.
Yeah.
Potentially with a lot of imagination involved, yes, depending on if you have maps or not, right?
It's a challenge.
It is.
Like, it's a legit challenge. Yeah.
Looping back around, like working with kids, we find this a lot where, you know, player A might get mad at player B because it doesn't mean the character, but they're taking it really personally because they're still learning those skills of communication and of not just like how to play a collaborative game together, how to play a TTRPG, but like, how do I talk to someone when I'm upset at them?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is this person attacking me, or is it something that we can just like hash it out? And like, I work with a lot of like 11 to 18 year olds who are learning that skill. We have to have very many conversations about, this is not a personal thing. It's a Dungeons and Dragons thing. And that means it's not, it's not real, though your personal feelings that come into it. And so there's a lot of just that table management skill is so, so big. Even in my adult games, it's just so big.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, I think of I have a bunch of table rules that I use for a lot of things, and I applied a lot of them initially to YDS stuff. And one of the ones is I don't do PvP.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because PvP is boring. It takes up too much time. And like, I'll tell kids that at the beginning of a quarter. I never like to call them kids. I like to call them players. But I'll tell my players that at the beginning, and some of them, like, it's boring. It takes up too much time. The only time I'm like, this is an absolute, but it is like, it just, it's like, it's taking away too much spotlight from everybody else.
Yeah.
That, you know, I think that sometimes you have to, you know, and I think that like some, I've been accused of railroading by kids. I mean, the last time I was accused of railroading by kids, they snuck onto the caboose of a train and were moving forward on the train little by little. And one of the kids says, I think you're railroading us.
Literally, you are. How dare you, dog?
You got on a train.
Yeah. Although I did mention at that point, although at any point you could get out of the train and climb forward.
See, that's why it's not a railroad.
Just get off. Yeah.
Any point you could have gotten off. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. You could have just left if you wanted to.
What's one concept about GMing you've successfully turned into a concrete tool or mindset shift for players through your content and through Pandas?
Okay, I was thinking about the Spark.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, it's good.
Yeah, which is a tool that is based on kind of, so because we're constantly talking about communication and we're constantly talking about basically consent at the table, one of the things that we came up with it for a game that we were designing at the time that maybe someday we'll get back to, but discovered that it works in like pretty much any game you want to put it into, is a concept of the Spark, right? Which is a tool for identifying if there is potential romance and basically getting player consent before playing into that, right? So you're not guessing. And it's a very simple tool. It just goes, you know, as a GM or another player, you can just be like, is there a spark here?
Hmm.
And an answer yes means that is a green light. Go ahead if you think there should be a little bit of romance, and you can ramp into that at whatever pace you have potentially pre-negotiated or want to negotiate on the side, whatever. And a no means you don't steer the story in that direction. And it means you never open that up again unless the player says, actually, I think there might be a spark here. So it's just a way to manage potential romantic relationships in a game, to make it really clear and to make it more comfortable, especially for folks who have different comfort levels with romance. If you have an ace person at your table, but you're playing a game that has a lot of romance in it or something,
or a bard,
like, as it,
right, there's a bard,
right? Like, you can just throw it out there. And it was based on a game that we designed where we basically expected all of the players to get into messy romantic entanglements all the time.
Mm.
But you need a way to be able to say, yes, this NPC, no, not that NPC, mm-hmm. right? It's quick and easy. So it's just a communication shorthand, but I know it works pretty well. I haven't implemented it in a lot of other games because it hasn't come up for me, but I also know that there are folks listening to our podcast who have implemented just that tool without ever playing the game because we never published the game. So we just talked about it on our podcast, and I know that that is a tool that is functional and usable. Yeah, and shared through a podcast.
I really like that because obviously we work a lot with kids, and yeah, I work a lot of what I call my little queer babies who are like trying to explore their sexuality and their identity through TTRPGs.
Absolutely.
And I think that would be an amazing tool for them to say, hey, is there a spark here between your character and this NPC to see if that is, you know, a part of their identity that might they're exploring but want to look at more.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean you have to do something. It just means, are we open to the story moving in that direction? And it just gives you the right information as a GM to be like, nope, okay, this is purely platonic. And like, we just, at this Y intersection, I turn left, instead of just sets you up for success to create the kind of relationship that a player wants.
I like that a lot. I might put that in my little toolkit because I have a few tools that I usually will keep in there. And I like the idea of having one that's very explicitly, like, this is for, if there is a romantic element potentially in this.
Yeah.
I like that. We're learning stuff too.
Yeah.
Everybody should take that and run with it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, we're not trying to hide it. We just never published the game. So it's not like published anywhere. It's only been talked about on Pandas a lot.
What about you, Phil?
I was trying to think of another one. I have one that I just recently incorporated, but I can't remember if it came from Pandas. I know I wrote about it in Gnome Stew, which is the post-session process. So I have gotten into a thing recently, like when my session's done, I go back and I tidy up all my notes. I kind of make sure that everything that happened in the game gets recorded into my campaign documents, and kind of I set myself up so that when I'm ready to prep the next time, I have like the best information possible, instead of what I used to do, which was like finish the game, say goodnight to everybody, go to bed, forget the game, you know, for a week or so until I was ready to prep it and come back and be like, what happened? And have to like go through, you know, through notes and things like that.
what do we do again?
What does this paper say?
Yeah.
Did I write this?
I do have like this whole thing now because I really got into using Obsidian for managing campaign data. And so like when I sit down at the end of the night, I update Obsidian. I put in entries for, you know, new NPCs, new locations, things like that. But then when I go to prep, like all that stuff's already in there.
I don't know if we talked about that specific thing on Pandas. We totally might have.
I know.
We can't remember.
We will.
But I know we talked about how to pick the right tools to support your GMing, which is a lot of that as well.
Yep.
I have two that I always do, which is one I call presumed competence, which is the characters are supposed to be good at things.
Yep.
And if there is no consequence to failure, narrative consequence to failure, then they just don't fail. They just succeed.
Yep.
And part of that, too, is almost always when there's a failure, I make the failure not something that's of their fault. The example I always use is that I described this one dungeon as being very damp and there was moss there and stuff. And the rogue goes to pick a lock and fails. And I say, well, you slip and bump your head into the door, like on the, you know, you're leaning into it and just moss you didn't see, you know. And then the other one is I like rerolls to mean something. I ran a 5e Star Wars game last summer where I used, I never do inspiration, but the rerolls were called, what's the line in every Star Wars movie? How did I just flake that? I wrote that a million times and I wrote an article about it.
Never tell me the odds?
No, it's,
the force is with you.
I got a bad feeling about this.
Okay,
cool. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so the kids would have to say, I've got a bad feeling about this, and they get a reroll.
Nice.
And then since then I've had one where player characters are from different dimensions and that when they want to reroll, they just reroll, but they convert to another version of themselves from a different dimension.
Oh.
And another one where time rewinds a little bit and like it's called an echo point. So like they're like actually like changing the direction of the world, and making those matter has been such a huge fun leap forward for me, even if it's just saying a phrase.
I like that.
I actually, one of the things I do in my game, especially for kids, is inspiration is a really big part of our ritual, but mm-hmm. I rarely give it out. They all get to vote on who gets inspiration each week. And that's like a very important ritual for us because I send out the Google form link at the end of the session. Beginning of session, I always get a question of, hey, Liv, where is the inspiration? Who won inspiration? And then they have an extended list of what they can do, which is actually based off, I think it's based off of your I Got a Bad Feeling from your Star Wars game, Jesse, because I remember you put it into the chat. So like they can do epic moments. They can like summon like an NPC or ally they've previously played with in that quarter. And it just like allows them to do a lot more than like, reroll a D20, because really at the end of the day, I don't want it to be so tied to that like mechanic of, oh, I got a 2. And so now I can't open a door. And that allows them to use it for very cool things.
Those moments should feel important. And like, I feel like anytime a character's doing something, it should feel important.
I'll give you an interesting twist on that from the game X-Crawl. X-Crawl has a kind of an inspiration system, but it's a pool that the players have like in front of them. The only thing is they can't take it for themselves.
Oh, okay.
Like somebody has to give it to somebody else, right? So they have to like at some moment in the game, just look over and just, you know, take a die and hand it to the other player or a point or whatever and be like, all right, you know, this means something, like, you know, do what you got to do.
Yeah, the mojo pool.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot.
Yeah. I think the other thing that people will find is like, as you play games, you'll find rules that you're like, hey, I bet I could apply it to this other game too.
Uh-huh.
I do that a lot.
Totally. Yeah.
Me doing rules is because I ran a whole bunch of Savage Worlds and was like, I like more of these.
Benny.
I want to get your bennies.
I actually prefer games that put some sort of mechanic into the player's hands for things like rerolls and stuff. Like I have said in years past, I only fudge die rolls for games where that mechanic is missing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because if the players have that mechanic, then if they choose not to reroll, right, and take the fail or whatever, that's on them,
mm-hmm.
right? That's on them, because dice are fickle, and sometimes dice and story don't cooperate, right? And depending on your feeling of how close you want this to feel like a story versus a game, sometimes you want it to go in a certain direction. I have certainly in the past, you know, many, many versions of Dungeons and Dragons ago, nudged die rolls, you know, in typically in players' favors, never really in my favor. because there's no point to that part. But I love when games just empower players. Like, that's now your choice.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, here's your stack of bennies, but you also know, like in, you know, Savage Worlds, you need bennies to soak damage.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You got to start making, like, when you have a lot of bennies, you don't have to, it's not as crucial of a decision, but as you run down on bennies, you're making some real choices in how the rest of the game's going to go if you are burning through them to make trivial rerolls when you are, you know, not saving them to soak damage. That, to me, is interesting.
Yeah, that's a cool, something. It's weird to get that, like, hey, I think about this all the time. Like, oh yeah, there's that other element.
The one I don't like is Numenera, where your experience points are used for reroll.
Yes.
You could advance or reroll.
Yeah, anytime experience points are an in-game resource, it's bad.
Yeah. My house rule for those Cypher games is that once you get the XP for advancement purposes, that's yours to keep.
Mm-hmm.
You can also now, you get like a reroll, you know, like you get the XP reroll token as well.
So it serves dual purpose.
The first household rule I ever made was for Marvel Superheroes, where you use karma. And karma is also your experience points.
Yes.
And the way I would work it is that your karma pool renewed from whatever your karma total was.
Okay.
And then you would have a separate track of karma for experience that is like what you have left.
Yeah, because otherwise Wolverine can't advance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
For those who don't know, because that's an old game.
Yeah, it's a very old game.
You lose all your karma if you kill somebody.
Wow.
So in the 80s,
that's
like,
crazy.
So if you're playing Wolverine, like one, your in-game karma is gone within the first combat. Like you're just, you know,
yeah.
The first couple minions you run into and Wolverine shanks them. It's like, well, okay, you're, you know, which is why we used to always joke. We had a joke when we played Marvel Superheroes that, you know, the Wolverine character would just put all of his karma on the first roll. Karma for Red.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm out. Good.
I feel like there was a lot of house rules that ended up coming up in there. But, you know, I think a lot of those 80s games, you house ruled a lot.
Oh, yeah. Also, there was no one talking to each other, right? You just had to fix problems yourself. Like, you just started making stuff up.
Hey, just come up with ideas. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, so, well, listen, we're going to move on to our peer review. Liv, would you like to take it away?
Yeah, let me first describe a little bit what about peer review is. If you can't tell, we're all nerds here, and I am also a really big nerd. And one of the things we thought about this podcast was, hey, we want to provide your resources, but I work in research and I love a scientific literature review. And so each session, we'll talk about a little bit of the scientific literature that's out there about TTRPGs. And so I actually want to start off with a question for Phil and Senda, because I think you have a background in this too, is, you know, how far back do you think the first scientific review and research into TTRPGs goes?
So I can see your notes, so I'm going to tell you, I actually didn't know that. I didn't know that, but I'm not terribly surprised, because those OG guys were all like college nerds, right? Like they were all war gamers and hung out in, you know, colleges and things like that. So I'm not surprised. It's an impressive date how far back it goes.
It is. Send any thoughts based on the document I've sent.
Yeah, no. I was just going to, my guess, because I didn't look at your notes, is actually was that, but I'm looking at them now.
I just got to remove it from the next run of show.
Yeah. Right. Just make sure you're not sharing spoilers, I guess. No, but my actual guess was pretty much as soon as games started coming out, because we know that people are talking about and writing they're writing papers about
these is
all of the things that are happening right now. Like, it doesn't have to be ancient history for people to write about it. It's really interesting to write things about cultural phenomenons that we're currently experiencing. Yeah, I actually am not super surprised by that date.
Well, let's talk about the dates since we've been alluding to it. I have two articles for us today. A Fantasy Games and Social Worlds, A Simulation as Leisure by Gary Allen Fine, that was published in 1981. And not to date myself, but I was not a concept in 1981.
I was in a womb in 1981. Yeah.
I was GMing.
Yeah. Phil was GMing. Just, yeah. Yeah.
I love this diverse range we have here.
Yeah. I wasn't GMing. What was I doing in 1981? I don't remember what I was doing. I think I was still getting beat up.
Well, this article by Fine from 1981 really discusses tabletop, specifically fantasy role-playing games, because that's what mostly was out there at the time, as a legitimate leisure practice that has its own norms, roles, and like meme making, as opposed to some of the ideas out there at the time that there was like, this is escapism, this is deviance, this is something different. And it really talks about the fantasy role-playing games as like their primary goal being enjoyment and fantasy, and refers it back to like education simulations as well, and explains why people are playing these games and what the benefits can be for them, which is really interesting. Talking about it more as like a organized social system. Another article I wanted us to talk about as well, exploring the landscape of role-playing game research through bibliometric analysis from 1986 to 2003 using Scopus databases by Nguyen et al. Super long name. Basically, they were doing their own little literature review, which I thought was very appropriate for the fact that I was going through and doing my own literature review.
Yes.
Where they took a look at things from 1986 to 2003 and that over time, how that research has changed. They actually took a look at, anyone want to guess? This isn't in the document. How many documents they looked at overall?
Oh, man. A lot, I'm sure.
I'm going to go like tens of thousands, right?
I'm going to go $1.
What?
It's not. Price is Right rules? Okay.
5,000.
A little less. So they started with about 3,000 records and got down to 1,152 documents via Prisma, which, if you don't know, I could go into that for a very long time, but I won't for the sake of our listeners. But basically, they kind of talked about the start of this research from this like quiet period where we didn't have as much from about 1986 to 2002, and then talking more about like game studies and infrastructure between, you know, 2017 to modern day, and along with talking about how it really is interdisciplinary. It connects to computer science, sociology, psychology. We'll talk a lot about psychology research into TTRPGs later on in the season, along with theater and drama-based research, which I don't know if everyone's familiar with. But hearing that, what are our first thoughts about, I guess, our peer review?
I mean, I love it, right? I love the idea of it. It doesn't surprise me, right, that psychology is a big part of this. Theater, of course, because of both performance and story structure. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of, we're doing the kind of, you know, untrained, informal version of this, right? Like, This is the, you know, we're talking about all these same things.
I wonder, and I don't know the dates because I just wasn't involved in TTRPGs for most of this, but do you think that sort of lull between 1986 and about 2002 was like the satanic panic and then the ramp back up into games being not scary anymore? Does that timeline align with that? I don't know.
Satanic panic's a little earlier than that.
A little earlier?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's satanic panic ended, I would say, like early 90s.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't saying that it necessarily went to 2002, but like that 1986.
There's overlap.
Yeah.
That late 80s to mid 90s, RPGs were not as big as they are today, right? That's the fall off of TSR. In 94 is when Wizards of the Coast purchases TSR. There were role-playing games, but that hobby was real. Like, that hobby was not, I don't want to say it wasn't doing much, because there were people definitely doing stuff, but it's pre-Forge, right? So it's before the Forge debates, when people got really scholarly and super nerdy about role-playing games again. It was a really kind of, a lot of people were making games, but it was real niche in that range of time.
At one point, TSR made a superhero game that just used cards to resolve things.
Love that game.
It's really good.
Again, Marvel Saga. Again, Doc, you showed Marvel it to the Saga. Camera.
I got it.
I know.
You it's to a Marvel say the words.
Adventure game.
Yep,
yeah.
Marvel Saga.
Yeah, Saga. Yeah,
that 86 to even into the 2000s, you had to like, you know, get a second mortgage on your house if you wanted to make a role-playing game.
Yeah.
It isn't like now where, you know, you've got tabletop, you know, you've got desktop publishing on your computer. You can run to Kickstarter and crowdsource something. You've got print on demand. Like, none of that existed, yeah. Right? If you wanted to make a game, you literally were taking mortgages on houses.
Yeah, you couldn't get a print run less than 2000. Copies, yeah. Right? That's generally a standard print run. So
even still in that time, like 1986, I think, to 1991 or somewhere around there, the only published licensed thing for Star Wars was the Star Wars role-playing game.
Which is the only thing that kept Star Wars alive.
It kept Star Wars alive. Like, And like so much of Star Wars canon that we just watch on TV now came from that. Like it's bonkers. So yeah, anyway, it's weird to kind of like reminisce about that time period.
It is weird. I do have to say it is weird when people do like historical analyses and things like that. I feel like the lion from Narnia, right? Like I often, you know, like, don't cite the old magic to me. I was there when it was written, right? Like, but that's how I feel. Cause I'm like, oh, I've played continuously since I first started. So I didn't have a break in the hobby. So when people mention dates, I'm like, yeah, what was I playing, right? And I just jogged through my memory to kind of remember, like, oh, 86 was, like, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and, the 90s were, you know, the beginning of all, like, the weird, like, that was the vampire, right? Mm-hmm. That was, like, the big, like, vampire arrived and...
White Wolves.
Yeah, it was the reign of White Wolf during those years, and the fall of TSR.
That's awesome. I love that those exist, honestly. I love that you found them, Lynn.
It took a while, but we went back pretty far. And I'm not saying that's the furthest back. I'm meaning that's the furthest back I could get in my days of research. There might be more.
Fair enough.
Let's close out today's session with one final question. So for Phil and Senda, you've done a lot of podcasts. You've done a lot of content creation. What makes a piece of RPG advice feel like a usable tool rather than just an interesting idea when delivered through a podcast?
You got to tie it to the table. Right. I love theory stuff. Like I will talk about role-playing theory to anybody for as long as you want. But for it to be useful, you have to get it back to how do you apply it at the table. Theory's nice, but if you're going to really do something with it, you have to be able to tie it to some activity, skill, or something that's occurring in your game so that you can affect the game in a meaningful way.
I think actionable is probably the only word I would add to that. Because sometimes we're giving people tools that are, or just discussing the concept of tools, maybe, that are not literal tools like the spark, or maybe just thinking about, you know, how do I improve this specific skill slice of my GMing experience? And it's just, how can we make that an actionable thing that someone can take and do? A lot of what we talk about, as we said before, is communication. But just saying to someone, yeah, I think you have a communication problem is not actionable.
Right? Yeah.
It's just like, hey, you just need to talk to each other. Awesome. Right. But like, how do you approach a conversation that might be difficult with people that you care about, but also might be frustrated with in this particular game scenario or whatever? So I think a lot of it is just making it actionable, getting it to the table.
It's making it as specific as possible. You immediately made me think of a time somebody yelled at me, "You suck." And I said, "Thanks for that feedback."
We called them glows and grows in education. Like, this is what you did well, but this is how you could grow, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite reviews I got for my first solo book, Never Unprepared, it's on DriveThruRPG. I'm pretty sure it's still there. It was like 1,000 words for a 1-star review.
What?
And you know what? Like, look, I'm sorry they didn't like it, but boy, they were not shy about what they didn't like about it. And I was like, that's great. I don't agree with all of the things you're saying in here, but at least you took the time to like really disagree with this.
Really,
right?
Well, homeboy got too much time on his hand. Right. I can't believe it. 1,000 word reviews.
But like a 2-star meh is like the worst review you can ever get. Right. I can't build from that. I can't improve something or address something. But boy, that person like really just didn't like the book. And I was like, respect. Like, it's okay. You didn't like it, but at least you told me why you didn't like it.
There's some useful stuff in here.
In detail. Yeah.
Yeah.
Detail. Okay.
Well, before we go, let's give our guests a moment to tell us where we can find them.
Oh, Senda, do this.
Yeah. I'm going to do the thing. We have
it's
a really
at the end
easy
of our
answer.
Podcast. Yeah, Senda, do this.
You can find us at polygamero.us/panda. So that's polygamerus/panda. And it has the place where you can find both Phil and I and all the social medias that we currently maybe maintain-ish, kind of. And also all the places you can find the podcast. And gosh, I'm just going to throw this in there because you gave me a moment to say it. If you're so inclined and you have questions that you want to hear us just talk about, that's how we run Pandas. It is an advice show. So please feel free to send us a topic on any of those channels. We love them.
We're like Car Talk for your game.
Yes.
I love that tagline. Well, thanks for spending time with us on the Forever GMs podcast. Thank you for joining us on our very first inaugural episode.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Congratulations. It's very exciting.
Thank you.
Many, many episodes.
Yes.
If you want to support the show, check out our Patreon in our links. We will have links to everything in our show notes, including the cited articles. Check out our Patreon for bonus content, behind the scenes goodness. And you can find us on TikTok and Blue Sky, which you can, believe it or not. And we're always looking for ideas on what we should tackle next. So if you have any ideas, reach out to our socials or email us at forevergms@docpalindrome.com.
They can't see it, Doc.
They can't see it. I know.
You can't do visual jokes. It's an audio medium.
Someday this will be a video watched by AI robots that have eaten us all. And remember, the Forever GMs never stop leveling up the table. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.